The price of gold hit an all-time high this spring, reaching nearly $1,250 an ounce. Gold got a boost from investors who were worried about the stability of the euro. In recent days, the price of gold has slumped, as many people decide it's best not to invest in anything at all. Still, gold remains a popular investment, and that is more than you can say for stocks these days, NPR's Wendy Kaufman reports.
The price of gold is about triple what it was just 5 years ago. It's a price that reflects worries about inflation, the decline in the value of the euro, and general uneasiness. Gold is real. It's not paper money. Ed Rice of the University of Washington's Foster School of Business adds that gold transcends cultural differences and is timeless.
It's a beautiful thing. It's a sign of prosperity or whatever people like about it, they have liked for hundreds of years. And so the thought is they'll continue to like it in the future.
Lots of us have gold, even if just a tiny bit. And some people are pawing through bottom drawers, jewelry boxes, and other stashes, looking for items that could bring them instant cash.
I knew that gold was fairly high right now, so I figured I'd bring it in and see what I could get.
What William Saxton brought into the yuppie pawn shop in suburban Seattle was a 1945 2-peso gold coin. But most of what comes into this upscale pawn store is gold jewelry.
There's one, two, I don't like that one. Three. All right, 4 pieces of gold. What do you think that's worth?
Brian Lurie, founder and co-owner of the store, has handed me a fistful of 14-karat gold jewelry. I haven't a clue what it's worth. He puts the jewelry on a scale and tells me he'd pay about $200 to $300 an ounce for this. It's a far cry from the commodity price, but can be a tidy sum nonetheless.
Every day we do get a lot of calls, and people are shopping on the phone. That's when I go into the store. Well, what we're going to offer you is all going to be in the range of what we can melt it down for. We're certainly not going to pay for the beauty of the gold.
Its meltdown value has been rising, and Lurie can often sell gold for twice as much as he pays for it. It represents a giant piece of his profits. Companies that urge consumers to mail in their gold for instant cash are chasing those profits as well.
If money is your thing, sell your nickels or ring.
We buy gold! 1, 2, 3!
For the top dollar you can get, find us on the internet at
We Buy Gold!
That's pretty typical of the kind of advertising and promotion that goes into this.
But Ben Popkin, a managing editor at The Consumerist, a consumers union website, is quick to suggest the problems in the mail-in gold industry are no laughing matter. The companies, and we aren't singling out this one, encourage you to mail in your gold. They promise to weigh it, assess it, and then send you a check. But, says Popkin,
lowballing is rife within the mail-in gold industry. People get checks back for pennies on the dollar. They're thinking maybe, hey, I'll get $100, a couple $100, whatever, and they get back a check for $9.
Another problem, he says, is that some companies lure consumers in with a money-back guarantee, but don't give them enough time to reject the amount they were sent and get their gold back. Many companies have denied engaging in unfair practices, but the spotlight is likely to remain on those who are trying to capitalize on gold fever. Wendy Kaufman, NPR News, Seattle.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel. There was reaction from all sides today to the Senate's passage of a new financial regulation bill. It's another step aimed at making U.S. financial markets safer for consumers and avoiding a repeat of the recent financial meltdown. Senator Christopher Dodd, who guided the bill through the Senate, said it's a strong bill for investors and consumers.
To give this country once again a sense of confidence and optimism about their financial institutions and the financial structures of our country.
The House and Senate will now work out the differences in their bills in a conference likely to take several weeks. NPR's John Itzde reports on other reaction to the legislation and the issues left to be resolved.
The scope of this legislation, more than 1,500 pages long, is vast. It attempts to end the problem of too big to fail by forcing financial institutions to hold more capital as a cushion against failure. It outlines a process for taking over and shutting down giant financial institutions that are failing. It forces the trading of derivatives, those controversial financial instruments at the center of the economic meltdown, out of largely unregulated markets onto public exchanges. And it creates an independent Consumer Financial Protection Bureau to shield consumers from fraudulent and dangerous financial products. Doug Elliott, a former investment banker, now a fellow at the Brookings Institution, thinks it's a significant achievement.
I'm pretty pleased with it. I think this gets us about two-thirds of the way to where we should be. And in the real world, that's a very good result.
But business and consumer groups had diametrically opposed responses to the Senate bill.
There's no question that the Wall Street Reform Bill is stronger than anyone expected it to be.
That's consumer advocate Ed Merzwinski of the U.S. Public Interest Research Group.
It's got a very strong consumer protection agency, even though the banks and the Chamber of Commerce spent millions of dollars trying to kill it, they lost.
Not surprisingly, a number of business advocacy groups see it differently. David Hirschman is with the U.S. Chamber of Commerce.
We're concerned about the overly broad, ill-defined consumer financial protection regulator. The powers are still ill-defined, and there are no checks and balances on the new regulator.
The Chamber and others who want to make changes in the legislation still have one more chance in the House-Senate Conference Committee that will iron out the differences in the bills passed by the two bodies. But since both versions contain a consumer protection entity, those against it will only be able to make marginal changes. One controversial issue that will have to be resolved is the exemption from oversight the auto dealers won in the House bill. The Senate bill doesn't give an exemption. Merzwinski says auto dealers will fight hard to keep it.
They make billions of dollars on unfair practices. They hurt all kinds of consumers with those practices, including military families. We're giving it our best shot, and it's going to be close.
Though a lot of business groups say they are very disappointed with the legislation that has emerged, the Financial Services Forum, which represents CEOs of some of the nation's largest financial institutions, is more positive. John Deary is the group's executive vice president.
Overall, I think that there is a general satisfaction with the reform, although there are still things that our membership is hoping might be made better in the conference.
One is the Senate bill's ban on the banks' trading of derivatives. The banks are likely to win that battle. That's because top financial regulators and the White House agree banks need to be able to trade derivatives to hedge risk. John Idstey, NPR News, Washington.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Robert Siegel, and here's a measure of the economy today. Time was, if we had five law students from a highly ranked law school, five people about to collect their law degrees and enter the job market, their prospects would typically make us feel at least a twinge of envy. First-year associate jobs that pay more than most people make deep into their careers, or prestigious clerkships or interesting government jobs before going to a law firm. In any case, a solid course toward repayment of all those student loans. Well, the recession may be technically over as far as the economics department is concerned, but for graduating third-year law students, even at Georgetown University Law School, the economy looks pretty bleak. And that's where our guests are from. And why don't the five of you introduce yourselves?
My name is Becca Richardson.
My name is Joel Florescu.
My name is Aaron Rowden.
My name is Jessica Bogo.
And my name is Jason Lewis.
Let's begin with Becca Richardson. Why don't you start by telling us what you'd really like to be doing next year, what you thought you'd be doing next year, and what you actually will be doing next year?
I will be going into the government next year, and I'm actually pretty excited about that opportunity. But it isn't something that, if you had asked me 10 months ago, it isn't something that
you
wouldn't
have said,
I'm
looking forward to working in the federal government after I
come. Well, I wouldn't have said that I'm looking forward to working where I am working in the future because I didn't know it existed. So,
why don't you tell us what agency you'll be working at?
I'll be working for the Federal Mine Safety and Health Review Commission, which is a very small independent agency.
Joel.
I had planned to get involved in international arbitration or maybe tax law. I also had some of an interest in labor law, but that's not going to happen. It seems that next year I think I'm going to join up with a friend of mine who already has her own small practice in California and just see how that works out.
Aaron Rowden, what did you look forward to doing next year and what do you now expect to be doing next year?
Well, when I first came to law school, my hope was that by this time I would have a job somewhere in the area of world trade, probably working for a non-governmental organization, maybe a firm. However, since those things haven't happened, I'm returning to the state of Maine so that I can run for the state legislature for District 84.
So you'll be able to run and say, I know what it's like in this economy to be looking for a job and not find one.
Certainly.
Jessica Bogo, what had you expected for this year, and now what do you expect?
Well, I went to law school just wanting to become a practicing litigator. I ended up working for a firm over the summer and loved it and would love to be working with them, but the economy the way that it is, we have a fellowship where we're working with a nonprofit organization for the first year. So for my first year out of school, I'll be working with the Volunteer Legal Services Program with the San Francisco Bar as a federal litigation attorney. So I still get to do what I want to do.
So explain this. You've been given a job by the law firm.
Yes.
But that job won't begin for another year and a half after you leave law school.
Right.
Jason Lewis, what about you?
Well, I left a PhD program to come to law school. And I don't know what I necessarily expected my job prospects would be, but I certainly thought I would be making, you know, six figures first year out. That is not going to be the case. Right now, I'm still sort of uncertain what I'm going to be doing after graduation, but I'm very strongly leaning towards the idea of just hanging out my own shingle and giving it a go as a solo practitioner.
I'm curious, all of you, generally, how many jobs have you applied for in this,
hundreds.
In this year? Hundreds.
And I think that's probably the case for all of us. Mm-hmm.
Certainly.
I've sent out at least 150 resumes and cover letters.
Joel?
I have to say that we five on this panel are a bit unrepresentative of the legal industry as a whole. I think that for a lot of the schools below us, it was a struggle for a very long time. Now their struggle has become our struggle. Now we have to deal with the same sort of problems that they've been facing. And we're not representative of the entire class of 2010. We're in a top law school.
Mm-hmm.
And just because we are struggling now doesn't mean that everyone else has had it hunky-dory for the past 10 years.
Georgetown typically rated at least among the top 15, if not the top 10 law schools in the country as the ratings change from year to year. So Joel's picture is a very pessimistic one, and I wonder whether that's one that the others among you share, or does this feel like a bad bump in an otherwise straight road that will work out well in the end? Jason Lewis.
I think that a lot of the real problem that's happened to the legal profession is that now we're suffering because the economics of the large law firm just doesn't work. You know, I think that's why you've seen not many of the firms have gone under, but one of the things that I hope that does come out of this is a restructuring of it. And maybe law students are going to have to realize that coming out of law school after a three-year education and expecting $160,000 a year, it's just not a realistic business model.
I do think that our generation, be it our year, the year behind us, and maybe the year in front of us or something mm-hmm. like that, I think we did kind of get the rough end of the stick just because we didn't know that mm-hmm. the economy was going to take a downturn when we signed up for X number of loans every year. And if the economy does turn around, which I'm optimistic maybe because I have to be, but if the economy does turn around and law firms start hiring again, they're not going to hire us. They're going to hire the classes behind us who are coming straight out of law school, who they can train up in the way that they always have.
Because this is a career in which you get on the escalator at a
yes.
particular time in a summer when you're at law school, and they look you over and you look
yes.
them over, and then you
law
enter,
firms generally don't hire you out of government or out of, you know, being a private practitioner. They generally hire you straight out of law school or from another comparable firm.
Does this feel to you like some piece of terrible economic weather that's hurting us for a couple of years, but, you know, the sunshine will come out, maybe we'll be set for a loss by it, but things are going to return to something like the old normal? Or do you feel that what's happening right now is some fundamental change in the way we live, support ourselves, and think about work? What do you think, Jessica Bogo?
What I think that the current economic climate has given us is an opportunity to really look at who we are and what we want and make sure that what we bring to the table is valuable. And so being able to really assess and make sure that what we are offering is valuable, I think, is a change that will be good going forward and I would hope would stay.
Well,
Jason,
what I think is we might actually end up looking at two separate legal economies. The one that is the big firm economy that we have now, it's not going to go away. But because you're going to end up with, you know, probably 5 years of lost attorneys, hopefully those attorneys will be able to innovate and will be able to create, you know, something that's different. Now, it's not going to replace the large scale law firms. But I think it gives us the opportunity to innovate, to create new ways of doing legal practice and legal services.
Well, good luck to all of you, and thanks to all of you for talking with us about your situation.
Thank you.
I'm talking to a third-year Georgetown University law students, Becca Richardson, Joel Florescu, Aaron Rowden, Jessica Bogo, and Jason Lewis.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Guy Raz. Sometime around the end of last summer, economists said the recession was over. But long-term unemployment is higher than it's been since the Great Depression, and growth is slowing. Add to that the dramatic declines on Wall Street these past few weeks, and you may be forgiven for asking, is it really over? We'll hear one economist's answer to that question in a moment, but first to financial regulation. With the passage of the Senate Finance Bill this week, Congress looks set to adopt the biggest regulatory changes to the financial industry since the 1930s. Those rules are designed, in theory, to prevent another collapse like the kind we saw in 2008. But what does it mean for the rest of us? We begin with NPR's Audie Cornish.
First of all, we're going to get a new regulator in the form of this Consumer Financial Protection Bureau or agency. So far, we've only had banking regulators, so they didn't know what to do with mortgage lenders who weren't banks, or an AIG, which sold insurance but also did some betting in other kinds of risky trades on the side.
They were focused on the big guys, not
on the
consumers.
Yeah, exactly. So you're going to have a consumer-oriented bureau which is going to watch over all the lending that's, you know, in your file cabinet at home. Your checkbook and your student loan and your mortgage, all that paperwork is going to be watched by someone. And then the regulators themselves as a whole will now be tasked with watching over the entire system to monitor for big sort of seismic shifts or changes. Is everyone starting to trade in one kind of thing, and what's that thing made up of? And the idea is that once they get a sense of what's going on, they can drill down and maybe address the problem.
Well, what does this mean for the average consumer? Will it mean that, mortgage paperwork will be easier? Will it mean that our credit card fees will go down? What does it mean for people, you know, like us?
Well, the Republicans who oppose the bill would probably say regulation never makes anything easier. So if you could think about it that way, you're going to have an agency now who is going to be looking at that mortgage. And if it's an adjustable rate mortgage or a subprime mortgage for someone who doesn't have great credit, things are going to be a lot more stringent. You won't be able to get a loan without really showing evidence you can pay for that loan. Mm. We've just come out of a few years where you didn't have to do that.
How would something like the regulation of financial derivatives affect consumers? That's also in the provision in there.
It's a huge part of the bill, and it's actually the most contentious part of the bill because it's a big unregulated market. Basically, bankers or investors or even farmers or airlines, they can call up banks and say, I think the price of oil is going to go down or up. Mm. I'm going to put some money down against that to protect me from when that price change happens. The problem is during the loan crisis, people were doing that with loans, bundled packages of loans, which are called mortgage-backed securities. So they were betting
default,
on whether whether these things would go up or down. They were betting on whether or not you were going to pay off your mortgage. And when a bunch of people didn't, that's when we saw the crisis. And we saw a company like AIG, the insurance firm, who had been dabbling in this kind of trading, fall apart.
So in theory, this is going to prevent that from happening.
It's going to set up a way to see further down the horizon if something like that is coming up, a little bit like a tornado, though. I mean, I think ostensibly it's supposed to be able to look out on the plains and say, that doesn't look right, what's coming down. I mean, the thing to understand about this bill is repeatedly we heard the author, Chris Dodd, the head of the banking committee, say, this is not going to prevent the next crisis. That's not the promise here. The promise is we will be able to handle the next crisis. Before, it was ad hoc. You had Ben Bernanke and Hank Paulson kind of in rooms making phone calls. This is going to make a system so that you don't have regulators going to lawmakers in the middle of the night and asking for $700 billion.
That's NPR's Audie Cornish. Audie, thanks so much.
Thank you.